borrowed prayer book flashed a long light down the years. She would have to go to church with Percy Gryce every Sunday. They would have a front pew in the most expensive church in New York, and his name would figure handsomely in the list of parish charities. In a few years, when he grew stouter, he would be made a warden. Once in the winter, the rector would come to dine, and her husband would beg her to go over the list and see that no divorcees were included, except those who had showed signs of penitence by being remarried to the very wealthy. There was nothing especially arduous in this round of religious obligations, but it stood for a fraction of that great bulk of boredom which loomed across her path. And who could consent to be bored on such a morning? Lily had slept well, and her bath had filled her with a pleasant glow, which was becomingly reflected in the clear curve of her cheek. No lines were visible this morning, or else the glass was at a happier angle. And the day was the accomplice of her mood. It was a day for impulse and truancy. The light air seemed full of powdered gold. Below the dewy bloom of the lawns, the woodlands blushed and smouldered, and the hills across the river swam in molten blue. Every drop of blood in Lily's veins invited her to happiness. The sound of wheels roused her from these musings, and leaning behind her shutters, she saw the omnibus take up its freight. She was too late then. But the fact did not alarm her. A glimpse of Mr. Gryce's crestfallen face even suggested that she had done wisely in absenting herself, since the disappointment he so candidly betrayed would surely whet his appetite for the afternoon walk. That walk she did not mean to miss. One glance at the bills on her writing table was enough to recall its necessity. But meanwhile she had the morning to herself, and could muse pleasantly on the disposal of its hours. She was familiar enough with the habits of Bellamont to know that she was likely to have a free field till luncheon. She had seen the Wetherells, the Trenor girls, and Lady Cressida packed safely into the omnibus. Judy Trenor was sure to be having her hair shampooed. Carrie Fisher had doubtless carried off her host for a drive. Ned Silverton was probably smoking the cigarette of young despair in his bedroom. And Kate Corby was certain to be playing tennis with Jack Stepney and Miss Van Osburgh. Of the ladies, this left only Mrs. Dorset unaccounted for, and Mrs. Dorset never came down till luncheon. Her doctors, she averred, had forbidden her to expose herself to the crude air of the morning. To the remaining members of the party Lily gave no special thought. Wherever they were not likely to interfere with her plans. These, for the moment, took the shape of assuming a dress somewhat more rustic and summer-like in style than the garment she had first selected, and rustling downstairs, sunshade in hand, with the disengaged air of a lady in quest of exercise. The great hall was empty but for the knot of dogs by the fire, who, taking in at a glance the outdoor aspect of Miss Bart, were upon her at once with lavish offers of companionship. She put aside the ramping paws which conveyed these offers, and assuring the joyous volunteers that she might presently have a use for their company, sauntered on through the empty drawing-room to the library at the end of the house. The library was almost the only surviving portion of the old manor-house of Bellamont, a long, spacious room, revealing the traditions of the mother country in its classically cased doors, the Dutch tiles of the chimney, and the elaborate hob-grate with its shining brass urns. A few family portraits of lantern-jawed gentlemen in tie-wigs, and ladies with large headdresses and small bodies, hung between the shelves lined with pleasantly shabby books. Books mostly contemporaneous with the ancestors in question, and to which the subsequent Trenors had made no perceptible additions. The library at Bellamont was in fact never used for reading, though it had a certain popularity as a smoking room or a quiet retreat for flirtation. It had occurred to Lily, however, that it might on this occasion have been resorted to by the only member of the party in the least likely to put it to its original use. She advanced noiselessly over the dense old rug, scattered with easy chairs, and before she reached the middle of the room she saw that she had not been mistaken. Lawrence Selden was in fact seated at its farther end, but though a book lay on his knee, his attention was not engaged with it, but directed to a lady whose lace-clad figure, as she leaned back in an adjoining chair, detached itself with exaggerated slimness against the dusky leather of the upholstery. Lily paused as she caught sight of the group. For a moment she seemed about to withdraw, but thinking better of this, she announced her approach by a slight shake of her skirts, which made the couple raise their heads, Mrs. Dorset with a look of frank displeasure, and Selden with his usual quiet smile. The sight of his composure had a disturbing effect on Lily, but to be disturbed was in her case to make a more brilliant effort at self-possession. "Dear me, am I late?" she asked, putting a hand in his as he advanced to greet her. "Late for what?" inquired Mrs. Dorset tartly. "Not for luncheon, certainly, but perhaps you had an earlier engagement."
"Yes, I had," said Lily confidingly.
"Really? Perhaps I'm in the way, then. But Mr. Selden is entirely at your disposal." Mrs. Dorset was pale with temper, and her antagonist felt a certain pleasure in prolonging her distress. "Oh, dear, no, do stay," she said good-humouredly. "I don't in the least want to drive you away."
"You're awfully good, dear, but I never interfere with Mr. Selden's engagements."
The remark was uttered with a little air of proprietorship, not lost on its object, who concealed a faint blush of annoyance by stooping to pick up the book he had dropped at Lily's approach. The latter's eyes widened charmingly, and she broke into a light laugh. "But I have no engagement with Mr. Selden. My engagement was to go to church, and I'm afraid the omnibus has started without me. Has it started, you know?" She turned to Selden, who replied that he'd heard it drive away some time since. "Ah, then I shall have to walk. I promised Hilda and Muriel to go to church with them. It's too late to walk there, you say?"
"Well, I shall have the credit of trying, at any rate, and the advantage of escaping part of the service. I'm not so sorry for myself, after all."
And with a bright nod to the couple on whom she'd intruded, Miss Bart strolled through the glass doors and carried her rustling grace down the long perspective of the garden walk. She was taking her way churchward, but at no very quick pace, a fact not lost on one of her observers, who stood in the doorway looking after her with an air of puzzled amusement. The truth is that she was conscious of a somewhat keen shock of disappointment. All her plans for the day had been built on the assumption that it was to see her that Selden had come to Bellomont. She had expected, when she came downstairs, to find him on the watch for her, and she had found him, instead, in a situation which might well denote that he had been on the watch for another lady. Was it possible, after all, that he had come for Bertha Dorset? The latter had acted on the assumption to the extent of appearing at an hour when she never showed herself to ordinary mortals, and Lily, for the moment, saw no way of putting her in the wrong. It did not occur to her that Selden might have been actuated merely by the desire to spend a Sunday out of town. Women never learn to dispense with the sentimental motive in their judgments of men. But Lily was not easily disconcerted. Competition put her on her mettle, and she reflected that Selden's coming, if it did not declare him to be still in Mrs. Dorset's toils, showed him to be so completely free from them that he was not afraid of her proximity. These thoughts so engaged her that she fell into a gait hardly likely to carry her to church before the sermon, and at length, having passed from the gardens to the wood path beyond, so far forgot her intention as to sink into a rustic seat at a bend of the walk. The spot was charming, and Lily was not insensible to the charm, or to the fact that her presence enhanced it. But she was not accustomed to taste the joys of solitude except in company, and the combination of a handsome girl and a romantic scene struck her as too good to be wasted. No one, however, appeared to profit by the opportunity, and after a half hour of fruitless waiting she rose and wandered on. She felt a stealing sense of fatigue as she walked. The sparkle had died out of her, and the taste of life was stale on her lips. She hardly knew what she had been seeking, or why the failure to find it had so blotted the light from her sky. She was only aware of a vague sense of failure, of an inner isolation deeper than the loneliness about her. Her footsteps flagged, and she stood gazing listlessly ahead, digging the ferny edge of the path with the tip of her sunshade. As she did so, a step sounded behind her, and she saw Selden at her side.
"How fast you walk," he remarked. "I thought I should never catch up with you."
She answered gaily, "You must be quite breathless. I've been sitting under that tree for an hour."
"Waiting for me, I hope," he rejoined. And she said with a vague laugh, "Well, waiting to see if you would come." "I seized the distinction, but I don't mind it, since doing the one involved doing the other. But weren't you sure that I should come?"
"If I waited long enough. But you see, I had only a limited time to give to the experiment."
"Why limited? Limited by luncheon?"
No, by my other engagement.
Your engagement to go to church with Muriel and Hilda?
No, but to come home from church with another person.
Ah, I see.
I might have known you were fully provided with alternatives. And is the other person coming home this way?
Lily laughed again. That's just what I don't know. And to find out, it is my business to get to church before the service is over.
Exactly. And it is my business to prevent your doing so, in which case the other person, piqued by your absence, will form the desperate resolve of driving back in the omnibus.
Lily received this with fresh appreciation. His nonsense was like the bubbling of her inner mood.
Is that what you would do in such an emergency? She inquired.
Selden looked at her with solemnity.
I am here to prove to you, he cried, what I am capable of doing in an emergency.
Walking a mile in an hour? You must own that the omnibus would be quicker.
Ah, but will he find you in the end? That's the only test of success.
They looked at each other with the same luxury of enjoyment that they had felt in exchanging absurdities over his tea table. But suddenly Lily's face changed, and she said,
Well, if it is, he has succeeded.
Selden, following her glance, perceived a party of people advancing toward them from the farther bend of the path. Lady Cressida had evidently insisted on walking home, and the rest of the churchgoers had thought it their duty to accompany her. Lily's companion looked rapidly from one to the other of the two men of the party, Wetherell walking respectfully at Lady Cressida's side with his little sidelong look of nervous attention, and Percy Grice bringing up the rear with Mrs. Wetherell and the Trenners.
"Ah, now I see why you were getting up your Americana," Selden exclaimed, with a note of the freest admiration.
But the blush with which the sally was received checked whatever amplifications he had meant to give it. That Lily Bart should object to being bantered about her suitors, or even about her means of attracting them, was so new to Selden that he had a momentary flash of surprise, which lit up a number of possibilities. But she rose gallantly to the defense of her confusion by saying, as its object approached, "That was why I was waiting for you, to thank you for having given me so many points."
"Ah, you can hardly do justice to the subject in such a short time," said Selden, as the Trenner girls caught sight of Miss Bart.
And while she signaled a response to their boisterous greeting, he added quickly, "Won't you devote your afternoon to it? You know I must be off tomorrow morning. We'll take a walk, and you can thank me at your leisure."
Chapter 6. The afternoon was perfect. A deeper stillness possessed the air, and the glitter of the American autumn was tempered by a haze which diffused the brightness without dulling it. In the woody hollows of the park there was already a faint chill, but as the ground rose the air grew lighter, and ascending the long slopes beyond the high road, Lily and her companion reached a zone of lingering summer. The path wound across a meadow with scattered trees. Then it dipped into a lane plumed with asters and purpling sprays of bramble, whence, through the light quiver of ash leaves, the country unrolled itself in pastoral distances. Higher up, the lane showed thickening tufts of fern under the creeping, glossy verdure of shaded slopes. Trees began to overhang it, and the shade deepened to the checkered dusk of a beech grove. The boles of the trees stood well apart, with only a light feathering of undergrowth. The path wound along the edge of the wood, now and then looking out on a sunlit pasture or on an orchard spangled with fruit. Lily had no real intimacy with nature, but she had a passion for the appropriate and could be keenly sensitive to a scene which was the fitting background of her own sensations. The landscape outspread below her seemed an enlargement of her present mood, and she found something of herself in its calmness, its breadth, its long, free reaches. On the nearer slopes the sugar maples wavered like pyres of light. Lower down was a massing of grey orchards, and here and there the lingering green of an oak grove. Two or three red farmhouses dozed under the apple trees, and the white wooden spire of a village church showed beyond the shoulder of the hill, while far below, in a haze of dust, the high road ran between the fields.
"Let us sit here," Selden suggested, as they reached an open ledge of rock above which the beeches rose steeply between mossy boulders.
Lily dropped down on the rock, glowing with her long climb. She sat quiet, her lips parted by the stress of the ascent, her eyes wandering peacefully over the broken ranges of the landscape. Selden stretched himself on the grass at her feet, tilting his hat against the level sun rays and clasping his hands behind his head, which rested against the side of the rock. He had no wish to make her talk. Her quick breathing silence seemed a part of the general hush and harmony of things. In his own mind there was only a lazy sense of pleasure, veiling the sharp edges of sensation as the September haze veiled the scene at their feet. But Lily, though her attitude was as calm as his, was throbbing inwardly with a rush of thoughts. There were in her at the moment two beings, one drawing deep breaths of freedom and exhilaration, the other gasping for air in a little black prison house of fears. But gradually the captive's gasps grew fainter, or the other paid less heed to them. The horizon expanded, the air grew stronger, and the free spirit quivered for flight. She could not herself have explained the sense of buoyancy which seemed to lift and swing her above the sun-suffused world at her feet. Was it love, she wondered, or a mere fortuitous combination of happy thoughts and sensations? How much of it was owing to the spell of the perfect afternoon, the scent of the fading woods, the thought of the dullness she had fled from? Lily had no definite experience by which to test the quality of her feelings. She had several times been in love with fortunes or careers, but only once with a man. That was years ago, when she first came out, and had been smitten with a romantic passion for a young gentleman named Herbert Melson, who had blue eyes and a little wave in his hair. Mr. Melson, who was possessed of no other negotiable securities, had hastened to employ these in capturing the eldest Miss Van Osburgh. Since then he had grown stout and wheezy, and was given to telling anecdotes about his children. If Lily recalled this early emotion, it was not to compare it with that which now possessed her. The only point of comparison was the sense of lightness, of emancipation, which she remembered feeling in the whirl of a waltz or the seclusion of a conservatory during the brief course of her youthful romance. She had not known again till today that lightness, that glow of freedom. But now it was something more than a blind groping of the blood. The peculiar charm of her feeling for Selden was that she understood it. She could put her finger on every link of the chain that was drawing them together. Though his popularity was of the quiet kind, felt rather than actively expressed among his friends, she had never mistaken his inconspicuousness for obscurity. His reputed cultivation was generally regarded as a slight obstacle to easy intercourse, but Lily, who prided herself on her broad-minded recognition of literature, and always carried an Omer Khayyam in her travelling bag, was attracted by this attribute, which she felt would have had its distinction in an older society. It was, moreover, one of his gifts to look his part, to have a height which lifted his head above the crowd, and the keenly modelled dark features which, in a land of amorphous types, gave him the air of belonging to a more specialised race, of carrying the impress of a concentrated past. Expansive persons found him a little dry, and very young girls thought him sarcastic. But this air of friendly aloofness, as far removed as possible from any assertion of personal advantage, was the quality which piqued Lily's interest. Everything about him accorded with the fastidious element in her taste, even to the light irony with which he surveyed what seemed to her most sacred. She admired him most of all, perhaps, for being able to convey as distinct a sense of superiority as the richest man she had ever met. It was the unconscious prolongation of this thought which led her to say presently with a laugh, "I have broken two engagements for you today. How many have you broken for me?" "None," said Selden calmly. "My only engagement at Bellamont was with you." She glanced down at him, faintly smiling. "Did you really come to Bellamont to see me?" "Of course I did." Her look deepened meditatively. "Why?" she murmured, with an accent which took all tinge of coquetry from the question. "Because you're such a wonderful spectacle. I always like to see what you are doing." "How do you know what I should be doing if you were not here?" Selden smiled. "I don't flatter myself that my coming has deflected your course of action by a hair's breadth.
That's absurd, since if you were not here, I could obviously not be taking a walk with you.
No, but your taking a walk with me is only another way of making use of your material. You are an artist, and I happen to be the bit of colour you're using today. It's a part of your cleverness to be able to produce premeditated effects extemporaneously.
Lily smiled also. His words were too acute not to strike her sense of humour. It was true that she meant to use the accident of his presence as part of a very definite effect, or that, at least, was the secret pretext she had found for breaking her promise to walk with Mr. Gryce. She had sometimes been accused of being too eager. Even Judy Trenor had warned her to go slowly. Well, she would not be too eager in this case. She would give her suitor a longer taste of suspense. Where duty and inclination jumped together, it was not in Lily's nature to hold them asunder. She had excused herself from the walk on the plea of a headache, the horrid headache which in the morning had prevented her venturing to church. Her appearance at luncheon justified the excuse. She looked languid, full of a suffering sweetness. She carried a scent bottle in her hand. Mr. Gryce was new to such manifestations. He wondered rather nervously if she were delicate, having far-reaching fears about the future of his progeny. But sympathy won the day, and he besought her not to expose herself. He always connected the outer air with ideas of exposure. Lilia had received his sympathy with languid gratitude, urging him, since she should be such poor company, to join the rest of the party, who after luncheon were starting in automobiles on a visit to the Van Osburghs at Peekskill. Mr. Gryce was touched by her disinterestedness, and to escape from the threatened vacuity of the afternoon, had taken her advice and departed mournfully in a dust hood and goggles. As the motor car plunged down the avenue, she smiled at his resemblance to a baffled beetle. Selden had watched her manoeuvres with lazy amusement. She had made no reply to his suggestion that they should spend the afternoon together, but as her plan unfolded itself, he felt fairly confident of being included in it. The house was empty when at length he heard her step on the stair and strolled out of the billiard room to join her. She had on a hat and walking dress, and the dogs were bounding at her feet. "I thought, after all, the air might do me good," she explained, and he agreed that so simple a remedy was worth trying. The excursionists would be gone at least 4 hours. Lily and Selden had the whole afternoon before them, and the sense of leisure and safety gave the last touch of lightness to her spirit. With so much time to talk and no definite object to be led up to, she could taste the rare joys of mental vagrancy. She felt so free from ulterior motives that she took up his charge with a touch of resentment. "I don't know," she said, "why you're always accusing me of premeditation."
"I thought you confessed to it. You told me the other day that you had to follow a certain line, and if one does a thing at all, it's a merit to do it thoroughly."
"If you mean that a girl who has no one to think for her is obliged to think for herself, I'm quite willing to accept the imputation. But you must find me a dismal kind of person if you suppose that I never yield to an impulse."
"Ah, but I don't suppose that."
"Haven't I told you that your genius lies in converting impulses into intentions?" "My genius," she echoed with a sudden note of weariness. "Is there any final test of genius but success? And I certainly haven't succeeded." Selden pushed his hat back and took a side glance at her. "Success. What is success? I shall be interested to have your definition." "Success," she hesitated. "Why, to get as much as one can out of life, I suppose. It's a relative quality, after all. Isn't that your idea of it?"
"My idea of it? God forbid."
He sat up with sudden energy, resting his elbows on his knees and staring out upon the mellow fields. "My idea of success," he said, "is personal freedom."
"Freedom? Freedom from worries?"
"From everything. From money, from poverty, from ease and anxiety, from all the material accidents. To keep a kind of republic of the spirit. That's what I call success." She leaned forward with a responsive flash.
I know, it's strange, but that's just what I've been feeling today."
He met her eyes with the latent sweetness of his.
"Is the feeling so rare with you?" he said.
She blushed a little under his gaze. "You think me horribly sordid, don't you? But perhaps it's rather that I never had any choice. There was no one, I mean, to tell me about the Republic of the Spirit."
"There never is.
It's a country one has to find the way to oneself. But I should never have found my way there if you hadn't told me."
"Ah, there are signposts, but one has to know how to read them."
"Well, I have known. I have known," she cried with a glow of eagerness. "Whenever I see you, I find myself spelling out a letter of the sign. And yesterday, last evening at dinner, I suddenly saw a little way into your republic." Selden was still looking at her, but with a changed eye. Hitherto he had found in her presence and her talk the aesthetic amusement which a reflective man is apt to seek in desultory intercourse with a pretty woman. His attitude had been one of admiring spectatorship, and he would have been almost sorry to detect in her any emotional weakness which should interfere with the fulfilment of her aims. But now the hint of this weakness had become the most interesting thing about her. He had come on her that morning in a moment of disarray. Her face had been pale and altered, and the diminution of her beauty had lent her a poignant charm. "That is how she looks when she is alone," had been his first thought. And the second was to note in her the change which his coming produced. It was the danger point of their intercourse that he could not doubt the spontaneity of her liking. From whatever angle he viewed their dawning intimacy, he could not see it as part of her scheme of life. And to be the unforeseen element in a career so accurately planned was stimulating, even to a man who had renounced sentimental experiments.
"Well," he said, "did it make you want to see more?
Are you going to become one of us?" He had drawn out his cigarettes as he spoke, and she reached her hand toward the case. "Oh, do give me one. I haven't smoked for days."
"But why such unnatural abstinence? Everybody smokes at Bellamont."
"Yes, but it is not considered becoming in a jeune fille à marier, and at the present moment I am a jeune fille à marier."
"Ah, then I'm afraid we can't let you into the Republic."
"Why not? Is it a celibate order?"
"Not in the least, though I'm bound to say there are not many married people in it."
"But you will marry someone very rich, and it's as hard for rich people to get into as the kingdom of heaven."
"That's unjust, I think, because, as I understand it, one of the conditions of citizenship is not to think too much about money, and the only way not to think about money is to have a great deal of it."
"You might as well say that the only way not to think about air is to have enough to breathe."
"That's true enough in a sense, but your lungs are thinking about the air, if you are not. And so it is with your rich people. They may not be thinking of money, but they're breathing it all the while. Take them into another element and see how they squirm and gasp."
Lily sat gazing absently through the blue rings of her cigarette smoke. "It seems to me," she said at length, "that you spend a good deal of your time in the element you disapprove of." Selden received this thrust without discomposure.
"Yes, but I have tried to remain amphibious. It's all right as long as one's lungs can work in another air. The real alchemy consists in being able to turn gold back again into something else, and that's the secret that most of your friends have lost."
Lily mused. "Don't you think," she rejoined after a moment, "that the people who find fault with society are too apt to regard it as an end and not a means, just as the people who despise money speak as if its only use were to be kept in bags and gloated over? Isn't it fairer to look at them both as opportunities which may be used either stupidly or intelligently, according to the capacity of the user?"
"That is certainly the sane view.
But the queer thing about society is that the people who regard it as an end are those who are in it, and not the critics on the fence.
It's just the other way with most shows. The audience may be under the illusion, but the actors know that real life is on the other side of the footlights.
The people who take society as an escape from work are putting it to its proper use. But when it becomes the thing worked for, it distorts all the relations of life."
Selden raised himself on his elbow.
"Good heavens," he went on, "I don't underrate the decorative side of life. It seems to me the sense of splendor has justified itself by what it has produced.
The worst of it is that so much human nature is used up in the process. If we're all the raw stuff of the cosmic effects, one would rather be the fire that tempers a sword than the fish that dyes a purple cloak. And a society like ours wastes such good material in producing its little patch of purple. Look at a boy like Ned Silverton. He's really too good to be used to refurbish anybody's social shabbiness. There's a lad just setting out to discover the universe. Isn't it a pity he should end by finding it in Mrs. Fisher's drawing room? Ned is a dear boy, and I hope he'll keep his illusions long enough to write some nice poetry about them. But do you think it's only in society that he's likely to lose them?
Selden answered her with a shrug. Why do we call all our generous ideas illusions and the mean ones truths? Isn't it a sufficient condemnation of society to find oneself accepting such phraseology? I very nearly acquired the jargon at Silverton's age, and I know how names can alter the colour of beliefs. She had never heard him speak with such energy of affirmation. His habitual touch was that of the eclectic, who lightly turns over and compares, and she was moved by this sudden glimpse into the laboratory where his faiths were formed. "Ah, you are as bad as the other sectarians," she exclaimed. "Why do you call your republic a republic? It's a close corporation, and you create arbitrary objections in order to keep people out."
"It is not my republic. If it were, I should have a coup d'etat and seat you on the throne.
Whereas, in reality, you think I can never even get my foot across the threshold. Oh, I understand what you mean. You despise my ambitions. You think them unworthy of me." Selden smiled, but not ironically.
"Well, isn't that a tribute? I think them quite worthy of most of the people who live by them."
She had turned to gaze on him gravely. "But isn't it possible that if I had the opportunities of these people, I might make a better use of them? Money stands for all kinds of things. Its purchasing quality isn't limited to diamonds and motor cars."
"Not in the least. You might expiate your enjoyment of them by founding a hospital."
"But if you think they're what I should really enjoy, you must think my ambitions are good enough for me."
Selden met this appeal with a laugh. "Ah, my dear Miss Bart, I am not divine providence to guarantee your enjoying the things you are trying to get."
"Then the best you can say for me is that after struggling to get them, I probably shan't like them." She drew a deep breath. "What a miserable future you foresee for me."
"Well, have you never foreseen it for yourself?"
Slow color rose to her cheek, not a blush of excitement, but drawn from the deep wells of feeling. It was as if the effort of her spirit had produced it. "Often and often," she said. "But it looks so much darker when you show it to me." He made no answer to this exclamation, and for a while they sat silent, while something throbbed between them in the wide quiet of the air. But suddenly she turned on him with a kind of vehemence. "Why do you do this to me?" she cried. "Why do you make the things I have chosen seem hateful to me, if you have nothing to give me instead?" The words roused Selden from the musing fit into which he had fallen. He himself did not know why he'd led their talk along such lines. It was the last use he would have imagined himself making of an afternoon's solitude with Miss Bart. But it was one of those moments when neither seemed to speak deliberately, when an indwelling voice in each called to the other across unsounded depths of feeling. "No, I have nothing to give you instead," he said, sitting up and turning so that he faced her. "If I had, it should be yours, you know." She received this abrupt declaration in a way even stranger than the manner of its making. She dropped her face on her hands, and he saw that for a moment she wept. It was for a moment only, however, for when he leaned nearer and drew down her hands with a gesture less passionate than grave, she turned on him a face softened but not disfigured by emotion, and he said to himself, somewhat cruelly, that even her weeping was an art. The reflection steadied his voice as he asked, between pity and irony, "Isn't it natural that I should try to belittle all the things I can't offer you?" Her face brightened at this, but she drew her hand away, not with a gesture of coquetry, but as though renouncing something to which she had no claim. "But you belittle me, don't you?" she returned gently. in being so sure that they are the only things I care for. Selden felt an inner start, but it was only the last quiver of his egoism. Almost at once he answered quite simply, "But you do care for them, don't you? And no wishing of mine can alter that." He had so completely ceased to consider how far this might carry him that he had a distinct sense of disappointment when she turned on him a face sparkling with derision. "Ah," she cried, "for all your fine phrases, you're really as great a coward as I am, for you wouldn't have made one of them if you hadn't been so sure of my answer." The shock of this retort had the effect of crystallizing Selden's wavering intentions. "I'm not so sure of your answer," he said quietly, "and I do you the justice to believe that you are not either." It was her turn to look at him with surprise, and after a moment, "Do you want to marry me?" she asked. He broke into a laugh. "No, I don't want to. But perhaps I should, if you did." "That's what I told you. You're so sure of me that you can amuse yourself with experiments." She drew back the hand he had regained and sat looking down on him sadly. "I'm not making experiments," he returned. "Or if I am, it's not on you, but on myself. I don't know what effect they are going to have on me. But if marrying you is one of them, I will take the risk." She smiled faintly. "It would be a great risk, certainly. I have never concealed from you how great." "Ah, it's you who are the coward," he exclaimed. She had risen, and he stood facing her with his eyes on hers. The soft isolation of the falling day enveloped them. They seemed lifted into a finer air. All the exquisite influences of the hour trembled in their veins and drew them to each other as the loosened leaves were drawn to the earth. "It's you who are the coward," he repeated, catching her hands in his. She leaned on him for a moment, as if with a drop of tired wings. He felt as though her heart were beating rather with the stress of a long flight than the thrill of new distances. Then, drawing back with a little smile of warning, "I shall look hideous in dowdy clothes, but I can trim my own hats," she declared. They stood silent for a while after this, smiling at each other like adventurous children who have climbed to a forbidden height from which they discover a new world. The actual world at their feet was veiling itself in dimness, and across the valley a clear moon rose in the denser blue. Suddenly they heard a remote sound, like the hum of a giant insect, and following the high road, which wound whiter through the surrounding twilight, a black object rushed across their vision. Lily started from her attitude of absorption. Her smile faded, and she began to move toward the lane. "I had no idea it was so late. We shall not be back till after dark," she said, almost impatiently. Selden was looking at her with surprise. It took him a moment to regain his usual view of her. Then he said with an uncontrollable note of dryness, "That was not one of our party. The motor was going the other way." "I know, I know." She paused, and he saw her redden through the twilight. "But I told them I was not well, that I should not go out. Let us go down," she murmured. Selden continued to look at her. Then he drew his cigarette case from his pocket and slowly lit a cigarette. It seemed to him necessary at that moment to proclaim, by some habitual gesture of this sort, his recovered hold on the actual. He had an almost puerile wish to let his companion see that, their flight over, he had landed on his feet. She waited while the spark flickered under his curved palm. Then he held out the cigarettes to her. She took one with an unsteady hand, and putting it to her lips, leaned forward to draw her light from his. In the indistinctness, the little red gleam lit up the lower part of her face, and he saw her mouth tremble into a smile. "Were you serious?" she asked, with an odd thrill of gaiety which she might have caught up in haste from a heap of stock inflections without having time to select the just note. Selden's voice was under better control. "Why not?" he returned. "You see, I took no risks in being so." And as she continued to stand before him, a little pale under the retort, he added quickly, "Let us go down." Chapter 7. It spoke much for the depth of Mrs. Trenor's friendship that her voice, in admonishing Miss Bart, took the same note of personal despair as if she had been lamenting the collapse of a house party. "All I can say is, Lily, that I can't make you out." She leaned back, sighing, in the morning abandon of lace and muslin, turning an indifferent shoulder to the heaped-up importunities of her desk, while she considered, with the eye of a physician who has given up the case, the erect exterior of the patient confronting her. "If you hadn't told me you were going in for him seriously, but I'm sure you made that plain enough from the beginning. Why else did you ask me to let you off bridge and to keep away Carrie and Kate Corby? I don't suppose you did it because he amused you. We could none of us imagine you putting up with him for a moment unless you meant to marry him. And I'm sure everybody played fair. They all wanted to help it along. Even Bertha kept her hands off, I will say that, till Lawrence came down and you dragged him away from her. After that, she had a right to retaliate. Why on earth did you interfere with her? You've known Lawrence Selden for years. Why did you behave as if you'd just discovered him? If you had a grudge against Bertha, it was a stupid time to show it. You could have paid her back just as well after you were married. I told you Bertha was dangerous. She was in an odious mood when she came here. But Lawrence's turning up put her in a good humor. And if you'd only let her think he came for her, it would never have occurred to her to play this trick. Oh, Lily, you'll never do anything if you're not serious." Miss Bart accepted this exhortation in a spirit of the purest impartiality. Why should she have been angry? It was the voice of her own conscience which spoke to her through Mrs. Trenor's reproachful accents. But even to her own conscience she must trump up a semblance of defense. "I only took a day off. I thought he meant to stay on all this week, and I knew Mr. Selden was leaving this morning." Mrs. Trenor brushed aside the plea with a gesture which laid bare its weakness. "He did mean to stay. That's the worst of it. It shows that he's run away from you, that Bertha has done her work and poisoned him thoroughly." Lily gave a slight laugh. "Oh, if he's running, I'll overtake him." Her friend threw out an arresting hand. "Whatever you do, Lily, do nothing." Miss Bart received the warning with a smile. "I don't mean literally to take the next train. There are ways." But she did not go on to specify them. Mrs. Trenor sharply corrected the tense. "There were ways, plenty of them. I didn't suppose you needed to have them pointed out. But don't deceive yourself. He's thoroughly frightened. He has run straight home to his mother, and she'll protect him." "Oh, to the death," Lily agreed, dimpling at the vision. "How you can laugh," her friend rebuked her. And she dropped back to a soberer perception of things with the question, "What was it Bertha really told him?" "Don't ask me. Horrors. She seemed to have raked up everything. Oh, you know what I mean. Of course there isn't anything, really. But I suppose she brought in Prince Varigliano and Lord Hubert, and there was some story of your having borrowed money of old Ned Van Alstyne. Did you ever?" "He is my father's cousin," Miss Bart interposed. "Well, of course she left that out. It seems Ned told Carrie Fisher and she told Bertha, naturally. They're all alike, you know. They hold their tongue for years, and you think you're safe, but when their opportunity comes, they remember everything." Lily had grown pale. Her voice had a harsh note in it. "It was some money I lost at bridge at the Van Osburghs. I repaid it, of course." "Ah, well, they wouldn't remember that. Besides, it was the idea of the gambling debt that frightened Percy. Oh, Bertha knew her man. She knew just what to tell him." In this strain, Mrs. Trenor continued for nearly an hour to admonish her friend. Miss Bart listened with admirable equanimity. Her naturally good temper had been disciplined by years of enforced compliance, since she had almost always had to attain her ends by the circuitous path of other people's. And being naturally inclined to face unpleasant facts as soon as they presented themselves, she was not sorry to hear an impartial statement of what her folly was likely to cost, the more so as her own thoughts were still insisting on the other side of the case. Presented in the light of Mrs. Trenor's vigorous comments, the reckoning was certainly a formidable one, and Lily, as she listened, found herself gradually reverting to her friend's view of the situation. Mrs. Trenor's words were, moreover, emphasized for her hearer by anxieties which she herself could scarcely guess. affluence, unless stimulated by a keen imagination, forms but the vaguest notion of the practical strain of poverty. Judy knew it must be horrid for poor Lily to have to stop to consider whether she could afford real lace on her petticoats and not to have a motor car and a steam yacht at her orders. But the daily friction of unpaid bills, the daily nibble of small temptations to expenditure, were trials as far out of her experience as the domestic problems of the charwoman. Mrs. Trenor's unconsciousness of the real stress of the situation had the effect of making it more galling to Lily. While her friend reproached her for missing the opportunity to eclipse her rivals, she was once more battling in imagination with the mounting tide of indebtedness from which she had so nearly escaped. What wind of folly had driven her out again on those dark seas? If anything was needed to put the last touch to her self-abasement, it was the sense of the way her old life was opening its ruts again to receive her. Yesterday, her fancy had fluttered free pinions above a choice of occupations. Now she had to drop to the level of the familiar routine, in which moments of seeming brilliancy and freedom alternated with long hours of subjection. She laid a deprecating hand on her friend's. "Dear Judy, I'm sorry to have been such a bore, and you are very good to me. But you must have some letters for me to answer. Let me at least be useful." She settled herself at the desk, and Mrs. Trenor accepted her resumption of the morning's task with a sigh which implied that, after all, she had proved herself unfit for higher uses. The luncheon table showed a depleted circle. All the men but Jack Stepney and Dorset had returned to town. It seemed to Lily a last touch of irony that Selden and Percy Gryce should have gone in the same train. And Lady Cressida and the attendant Wetherells had been dispatched by motor to lunch at a distant country house. At such moments of diminished interest, it was usual for Mrs. Dorset to keep her room till the afternoon. But on this occasion she drifted in when luncheon was half over, hollow-eyed and drooping, but with an edge of malice under her indifference. She raised her eyebrows as she looked about the table. "How few of us are left! I do so enjoy the quiet, don't you, Lily? I wish the men would always stop away. It's really much nicer without them." "Oh, you don't count, George. One doesn't have to talk to one's husband." "But I thought Mr. Gryce was to stay for the rest of the week," she added inquiringly. "Didn't he intend to, Judy? He's such a nice boy. I wonder what drove him away. He is rather shy, and I'm afraid we may have shocked him. He's been brought up in such an old-fashioned way. Do you know, Lily, he told me he had never seen a girl play cards for money till he saw you doing it the other night. And he lives on the interest of his income and always has a lot left over to invest." Mrs. Fisher leaned forward eagerly. "I do believe it is someone's duty to educate that young man. It is shocking that he has never been made to realize his duties as a citizen. Every wealthy man should be compelled to study the laws of his country." Mrs. Dorset glanced at her quietly. "I think he has studied the divorce laws. He told me he had promised the bishop to sign some kind of a petition against divorce." Mrs. Fisher reddened under her powder, and Stepney said with a laughing glance at Miss Bart, "I suppose he's thinking of marriage and wants to tinker up the old ship before he goes aboard." His betrothed looked shocked at the metaphor, and George Dorset exclaimed with a sardonic growl, "Poor devil! It isn't the ship that will do for him, it's the crew." "Or the stowaways," said Miss Corby brightly. "If I contemplated a voyage with him, I should try to start with a friend in the hold." Miss Van Osburgh's vague feeling of pique was struggling for appropriate expression. "I'm sure I don't see why you laugh at him. I think he's very nice," she exclaimed. "And at any rate, a girl who married him would always have enough to be comfortable." She looked puzzled at the redoubled laughter which hailed her words, but it might have consoled her to know how deeply they had sunk into the breast of one of her hearers. Comfortable. At that moment the word was more eloquent to Lily Bart than any other in the language. She could not even pause to smile over the heiress's view of a colossal fortune as a mere shelter against want. Her mind was filled with the vision of what that shelter might have been to her. Mrs. Dorset's pinpricks did not smart, for her own irony cut deeper. No one could hurt her as much as she was hurting herself, for no one else, not even Judy Trenor, knew the full magnitude of her folly. She was roused from these unprofitable considerations by a whispered request from her hostess, who drew her apart as they left the luncheon table. "Lily, dear, if you've nothing special to do, may I tell Carrie Fisher that you intend to drive to the station and fetch Gus? He will be back at 4, and I know she has it in her mind to meet him. Of course, I'm very glad to have him amused, but I happen to know that she has bled him rather severely since she's been here, and she is so keen about going to fetch him that I fancy she must have got a lot more bills this morning. It seems to me," Mrs. Trenor feelingly concluded, "that most of her alimony is paid by other women's husbands." Miss Bart, on her way to the station, had leisure to muse over her friend's words and their peculiar application to herself. Why should she have to suffer for having once, for a few hours, borrowed money of an elderly cousin, when a woman like Carrie Fisher could make a living unrebuked from the good nature of her men friends and the tolerance of their wives? It all turned on the tiresome distinction between what a married woman might and a girl might not do. Of course it was shocking for a married woman to borrow money, and Lily was expertly aware of the implication involved. But still, it was the mere malum prohibitum which the world decries but condones, and which, though it may be punished by private vengeance, does not provoke the collective disapprobation of society. To Miss Bart, in short, no such opportunities were possible. She could, of course, borrow from her women friends, 100 here or there at the utmost, but they were more ready to give a gown or a trinket, and looked a little askance when she hinted her preference for a check. Women were not generous lenders, and those among whom her lot was cast were either in the same case as herself, or else too far removed from it to understand its necessities. The result of her meditations was the decision to join her aunt at Richfield. She could not remain at Bellamont without playing bridge and being involved in other expenses, and to continue her usual series of autumn visits would merely prolong the same difficulties. She had reached a point where abrupt retrenchment was necessary, and the only cheap life was a dull life. She would start the next morning for Richfield. At the station, she thought Gus Trenor seemed surprised and not wholly unrelieved to see her. She yielded up the reins of the light runabout in which she had driven over, and as he climbed heavily to her side, crushing her into a scant third of the seat, he said, "Hello. It isn't often you honour me. You must have been uncommonly hard up for something to do." The afternoon was warm, and propinquity made her more than usually conscious that he was red and massive, and that beads of moisture had caused the dust of the train to adhere unpleasantly to the broad expanse of cheek and neck which he turned to her. But she was aware also, from the look in his small, dull eyes, that the contact with her freshness and slenderness was as agreeable to him as the sight of a cooling beverage. The perception of this fact helped her to answer gaily, "It's not often I have the chance. There are too many ladies to dispute the privilege with me."
"The privilege of driving me home? Well, I'm glad you won the race, anyhow. But I know what really happened. My wife sent you, now didn't she?"
He had the dull man's unexpected flashes of astuteness, and Lily could not help joining in the laugh with which he had pounced on the truth. "You see, Judy thinks I'm the safest person for you to be with, and she's quite right," she rejoined.
"Oh, is she, though? If she is, it's because you wouldn't waste your time on an old hulk like me. We married men have to put up with what we can get. All the prizes are for the clever chaps who've kept a free foot. Let me light a cigar, will you? Had a beastly day of it."
He drew up in the shade of the village street and passed the reins to her while he held a match to his cigar. The little flame under his hand cast a deeper crimson on his puffing face, and Lily averted her eyes with a momentary feeling of repugnance. And yet some women thought him handsome. As she handed back the reins, she said sympathetically, "Did you have such a lot of tiresome things to do?"
"I should say so, rather."
Trenor, who was seldom listened to, either by his wife or her friends, settled down into the rare enjoyment of a confidential talk.
"You don't know how a fellow has to hustle to keep this kind of thing going."
He waved his whip in the direction of the Bellamont acres, which lay outspread before them in opulent undulations.
"Judy has no idea of what she spends, not that there isn't plenty to keep the thing going," he interrupted himself. "But a man has got to keep his eyes open and pick up all the tips he can." My father and mother used to live like fighting cocks on their income, and put by a good bit of it, too, luckily for me. But at the pace we go now, I don't know where I should be if it weren't for taking a flyer now and then. The women all think, I mean, Judy thinks, I've nothing to do but go downtown once a month and cut off coupons. But the truth is, it takes a devilish lot of hard work to keep the machinery running. Not that I ought to complain today, though, he went on after a moment. For I did a very neat stroke of business, thanks to Stepney's friend Rosedale. By the way, Miss Lily, I wish you'd try to persuade Judy to be decently civil to that chap. He's going to be rich enough to buy us all out one of these days, and if she'd only ask him to dine now and then, I could get almost anything out of him. The man is mad to know the people who don't want to know him, and when a fellow's in that state, there's nothing he won't do for the first woman who takes him up.
Lily hesitated a moment. The first part of her companion's discourse had started an interesting train of thought, which was rudely interrupted by the mention of Mr. Rosedale's name. She uttered a faint protest. "But, you know, Jack did try to take him about, and he was impossible."
"Oh, hang it, because he's fat and shiny and has a sharpy manner. Well, all I can say is that the people who are clever enough to be civil to him now will make a mighty good thing of it. A few years from now he'll be in it whether we want him or not, and then he won't be giving away $500,000 tip for dinner."
Lily's mind had reverted from the intrusive personality of Mr. Rosedale to the train of thought set in motion by Trenor's first words. This vast, mysterious Wall Street world of tips and deals, might she not find in it the means of escape from her dreary predicament? She had often heard of women making money in this way through their friends. She had no more notion than most of her sex of the exact nature of the transaction, and its vagueness seemed to diminish its indelicacy. She could not indeed imagine herself in any extremity stooping to extract a tip from Mr. Rosedale. But at her side was a man in possession of that precious commodity, and who, as the husband of her dearest friend, stood to her in a relation of almost fraternal intimacy. In her inmost heart, Lily knew it was not by appealing to the fraternal instinct that she was likely to move Gus Trenor. But this way of explaining the situation helped to drape its crudity, and she was always scrupulous about keeping up appearances to herself. Her personal fastidiousness had a moral equivalent, and when she made a tour of inspection in her own mind, there were certain closed doors she did not open. As they reached the gates of Bellamont, she turned to Trenor with a smile. "The afternoon is so perfect. Don't you want to drive me a little further? I've been rather out of spirits all day, and it's so restful to be away from people, with someone who won't mind if I'm a little dull." She looked so plaintively lovely as she proffered the request, so trustfully sure of his sympathy and understanding, that Trenor felt himself wishing that his wife could see how other women treated him, not battered wire-pullers like Mrs. Fisher, but a girl that most men would have given their boots to get such a look from.
"Out of spirits? Why on earth should you ever be out of spirits? Is your last box of Ducey dresses a failure? Or did Judy rook you out of everything at bridge last night?"
Lily shook her head with a sigh. "I've had to give up Ducey, and bridge, too. I can't afford it. In fact, I can't afford any of the things my friends do. And I'm afraid Judy often thinks me a bore because I don't play cards any longer, and because I'm not as smartly dressed as the other women. But you will think me a bore, too, if I talk to you about my worries, and I only mention them because I want you to do me a favor, the very greatest of favors." Her eyes sought his once more, and she smiled inwardly at the tinge of apprehension that she read in them.
"Why, of course, if it's anything I can manage."
He broke off, and she guessed that his enjoyment was disturbed by the remembrance of Mrs. Fisher's methods. "The greatest of favors," she rejoined gently. "The fact is, Judy is angry with me, and I want you to make my peace."
"Angry with you? Oh, come, nonsense."
His relief broke through in a laugh.
"Why, you know, she's devoted to you."
"She's the best friend I have, and that's why I mind having to vex her. But I dare say you know what she has wanted me to do. She has set her heart, poor dear, on my marrying a great deal of money." She paused with a slight falter of embarrassment, and Trenor, turning abruptly, fixed on her a look of growing intelligence.
"A great deal of money? Oh, by Jove, you don't mean grice. What, you do? Oh, no, of course I won't mention it. You can trust me to keep my mouth shut. But Grice, good Lord, Grice. Did Judy really think you could bring yourself to marry that pretentious little ass? But you couldn't, eh? So you gave him the sack, and that's the reason why he lit out by the first train this morning.
He leaned back, spreading himself farther across the seat, as if dilated by the joyful sense of his own discernment.
How on earth could Judy think you would do such a thing? I could have told her you'd never put up with such a little milksop.
Lily sighed more deeply. I sometimes think, she murmured, that men understand a woman's motives better than other women do.
Some men, I'm certain of it. I could have told Judy, he repeated, exulting in the implied superiority over his wife.
I thought you would understand. That's why I wanted to speak to you, Miss Bart rejoined. I can't make that kind of marriage. It's impossible. But neither can I go on living as all the women in my set do. I'm almost entirely dependent on my aunt, and though she's very kind to me, she makes me no regular allowance, and lately I've lost money at cards, and I don't dare tell her about it. I've paid my card debts, of course, but there's hardly anything left for my other expenses, and if I go on with my present life, I shall be in horrible difficulties. I've a tiny income of my own, but I'm afraid it's badly invested, for it seems to bring in less every year, and I'm so ignorant of money matters that I don't know if my aunt's agent, who looks after it, is a good adviser. She paused a moment and added in a lighter tone, I didn't mean to bore you with all this, but I want your help in making Judy understand that I can't at present go on living as one must live among you all. I'm going away tomorrow to join my aunt at Richfield, and I shall stay there for the rest of the autumn and dismiss my maid and learn how to mend my own clothes. At this picture of loveliness in distress, the pathos of which was heightened by the light touch with which it was drawn, a murmur of indignant sympathy broke from Trenor. 24 hours earlier, if his wife had consulted him on the subject of Miss Bart's future, he would have said that a girl with extravagant tastes and no money had better marry the first rich man she could get. But with the subject of discussion at his side, turning to him for sympathy, making him feel that he understood her better than her dearest friends, and confirming the assurance by the appeal of her exquisite nearness, he was ready to swear that such a marriage was a desecration, and that as a man of honour he was bound to do all he could to protect her from the results of her disinterestedness. This impulse was reinforced by the reflection that if she had married Grice, she would have been surrounded by flattery and approval, whereas having refused to sacrifice herself to expediency,